From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Ferguson holds the spotlight. ISIS beheads an American. Texas Governor Rick Perry booked on a felony charge, defiant. And more tension on the border of Russia and Ukraine. In Ferguson, Missouri, protests, National Guard, and many rough nights.
This is unacceptable. Until we get justice, we will not stop.
American journalist James Foley beheaded in the desert on video by ISIS. President Obama responded.
The United States of America will continue to do what we must do to protect our people. We will be vigilant and we will be relentless.
And Americans Nancy Reitwall and Dr. Kent Brantley survive Ebola. Out of the hospital in Atlanta, here's Brantley.
Today is a miraculous day. I'm thrilled to be alive, to be well, and to be reunited with my family.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Margaret Brennan of CBS News, Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What have we learned in Ferguson with ISIS, with Ebola? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me today from Washington, Margaret Brennan, State Department correspondent for CBS News. Margaret, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. Happy Friday.
Also from Washington, Clarence Page joins us, Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated columnist for the Tribune Media Service, member of the Chicago Tribune's editorial board. Clarence Page, welcome back to you as well, sir.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a long time.
Yes, it has. Good to have you. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Margaret, and Clarence.
So many powerful images in this last week from all over the place. Terrible image out of the desert, where ISIS beheaded American journalist James Foley on Wednesday in front of their home in Rochester, New Hampshire. James Foley's parents spoke to the media. Here's his father, John.
We need the courage and the prayers now to continue without him. Because he was an inspiration for us and for so many others. So we miss his courage, his love, his determination. His laugh, his smile.
And on the same day, from his vacation environs in Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, President Obama talked about the Islamic State, or ISIS, or ISIL, and the death of James Foley.
There has to be a common effort to extract this cancer so that it does not spread. There has to be a clear rejection of these kind of nihilistic ideologies. One thing we can all agree on is that a group like ISIL has no place in the 21st century.
Margaret Brennan, I want to come to you on policy options here. Clarence Page, can I just get a gut check with you for a second on this, the images out of that desert, Foley on his knees in the orange jumpsuit, the ISIS guy with the, we're told, East or South London accent, and then absolutely gruesome. I recommend no one actually watch the video. But that image, Clarence, how did it strike you?
Well, on several levels, Tom, as a father, first of all, my heart just goes out to the family there. I just can't begin to imagine what this week has been like for them. Secondly, as a journalist and as a member of the board of the Committee to Protect Journalists, I am appalled, and so is the CPJ. This is the kind of image we have not seen in several years as far as, you know, an American being.
Yeah, there was Nick Berg way back, Daniel Pearl, of course, years ago, but here, terrible.
Exactly. And that's significant because this gets to another angle maybe you're about to get to, which is whether or not the U.S. ought to pay ransom, because kidnapping for ransom is the major income now for Al-Qaeda. They started out, as you know, getting lots of donations from wealthy deep pocket donors here and there. But over time now, they've discovered kidnapping and ransom, much like Latin American gangsters and all, is a major income. And the U.S. and Britain have refused to pay, while other European countries have paid. And part of the result, apparently, is a lot fewer Americans getting kidnapped. But who knows? That could change with ISIS.
$132 million ransom demand, we are told, though whether that was serious or not at that scale, it's hard to say. The United States not paying up on the James Foley front. And the Islamic State, we're told, yes, they've made a lot of money off ransoms, Margaret Brennan, but now they've got territory, they've got oil, they've got almost a system of taxation within that territory. What, as far as you can tell, are the options that the U.S. is now considering or already engaged in, Margaret, for responding to ISIS very much on the move?
Right. Well, you're correct to say, I mean, ISIS's goal is to set up a caliphate, basically a state unto itself. And essentially, they've done that already inside of Syria and really erased the border between Iraq and Syria. It's oil and the revenues there that are really bringing in cash. And what we heard from the Pentagon top officials here yesterday was that in order to defeat ISIS, not just contain it, but defeat it in the long term, it is going to require military action, airstrikes inside of Syria. But officials at the Pentagon gave no indication that the president is about to authorize them. The strategy is still long term. Peel away support, get locals to reject ISIS's ideology, try to build more inclusive governments, really more of an economic and diplomatic strategy, and try to build an international coalition to carry out any type of military action. Question still remains, is the U.S. going to help arm and train and equip some of the moderates inside of Syria who could bring the fight to ISIS? Those plans have been pushed off for years here. The funding request not even going to Congress until 2015.
The language that was laid out this week certainly kind of clearing the way for almost anything here. President Obama calling them a cancer. James Comey, the FBI, calling ISIS savages. Here was Chuck Hagel, Secretary of Defense, yesterday at the Pentagon.
I don't know any other way to describe it other than barbaric. They have no standard of decency, of responsible human behavior, and I think the record's pretty clear on that. So, yes, they are an imminent threat to every interest we have, whether it's in Iraq or anywhere else.
An imminent threat to every interest we have. Jack Beatty, that leaves open a pretty wide field of response.
It certainly does. You know, thus far, the president enjoys rare majority support for bombing ISIL. But in a USA Today poll, it was taken before Foley's murder, 51% worried that mission creep might yet pull us back into Iraq. This week, the president said, no U.S. boots on the ground. Typically, he said, what happens with mission creep is we start deciding that we're the ones who have to do it all ourselves. Here, the president echoed the ignored wisdom of JFK, who in his last interview on Vietnam and speaking of the South Vietnamese, told Chet Huntley, in the final analysis, it's their war, their country. Obama's protecting Americans' rationale for bombing, it's already been stretched to justify the Mosul strikes. A dam breach, he said, might have endangered the embassy in Baghdad, 250 long miles away. Meanwhile, John Kerry's tweeted reaction to Foley's murder, quote, ISIL will be destroyed, crushed. That went way beyond protecting Americans. It was imbued with the spirit more of mission gallop.
The president saying we have to have effective partners on the ground, but mission creep can mean all kinds of things. Margaret, I think it was you that put the question to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey, General Dempsey, yesterday, about whether or not ISIS could be defeated without going into Syria. You mentioned this, but here he is, General Dempsey, in response to Margaret Brennan's question.
Can they be defeated without addressing that part of their organization which resides in Syria? The answer is no. That will have to be addressed on both sides of what is essentially at this point a non-existent border. And that will come when we have a coalition in the region that takes on the task of defeating ISIS over time.
Margaret, is the United States putting together such a coalition? George H.W. Bush did it in the Gulf War. Of course, there was a coalition. We were told, reminded again and again, in the Iraq War. Is that being put together now?
There is a coalition that the U.S. is trying to build. A lot of that has to do with partners in the region. When they say that, they mean the surrounding countries. You're talking about Jordan, a country that shares a border that is very concerned about the stability there and ISIS fighters coming in, Saudi Arabia, others who have a lot of skin in the game. Remember here, Iran is also a direct enemy of ISIS. There are a lot of countries who don't want to see ISIS go any further and are already striking back. So this isn't a matter of the U.S. really going alone. It's sort of a false comparison when so many people think back to the old Iraq, right? The previous, the last war. The issue with asymmetrical warfare, like what we're seeing with the execution of this American journalist, is that there's no waiting for the American military. Being American was the reason that James Foley was executed, and that fight is going to continue whether or not there is an appetite for it among the American public.
But how do you put a coalition together, Margaret? I mean, Iran is not going to fight side by side with Saudi Arabia. A lot of this is seen as proxy war. They might fight each other somehow here. What would a coalition look like?
Iran already is fighting ISIS. You're already seeing that on the ground. You have Iranian fighters on the ground inside of Iraq. You are seeing Saudi Arabia have a real interest into fighting ISIS. Strangely, they're on the same page here, though they never say it that way. But the U.S. is trying to get some of those wealthy Gulf countries to help fund some of this. They're trying to get European allies to participate in it. And they're really looking at different security solutions. But it still stands out here that really the air power is one that the United States has at the moment. And you certainly don't see that in Iraq. They have a very weak air force. And so that's why the U.S. has been conducting strikes basically on their behalf and that of the Kurds.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news with Margaret Brennan of CBS News, State Department correspondent there, columnist Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune, and our own Jack Beatty, Ferguson and Russian trucks in Ukraine, Rick Perry with his mugshot, and of course, the terrible beheading of American journalist on video, James Foley, this week. Everyone just sickened by that. Let's go to Nate in Milwaukee. Nate, you're on. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for having me, Tom. I was going to say, well, of the issues you mentioned, the most life and death is ISIS, which is a brutal group, but I'd be very wary of making a deal with Assad to a fight to attack them, because in the three-way civil war that's been going on, he directed his air force to focus on the Free Syrian Army, I suspect in hopes that ISIS would attack the FSA for him, or and make his life that much easier. And we should do something about them, but if he ignored the peace talks that Obama dragged the FSA into earlier, we should really, I think, make him pay a concession to them in order for any sort of cooperation.
Nate, I appreciate your call and that thought. I mean, Margaret Brennan, this is a very nuanced chess game here with Assad. You mentioned earlier, will the U.S. support moderates? Will they end up allied with him? We hear reports today that European intelligence has already been in talking with Assad because he traditionally presented himself as a bulwark against this kind of jihadi push that ISIS represents. Is it too late for the U.S. to deal with the moderates in Syria who desperately wanted a change of government there, a more democratic government there? Do we now, are we faced with a choice between ISIS or, whether we say it or not, realigning with Assad? Our Milwaukee caller does not want to see that.
Well, look, if the argument is that no one's going to do the fighting for the moderate Syrians, the hope is that if you want them to win, you got to give them a way to do so. Because certainly they are out-financed, they are out-armed, and they are out-strategized by ISIS, by some of the more extreme groups. That was one of the arguments people made for providing weapons and funding to the moderates.
Isn't it too late?
It's too hard to make that call right now, because certainly there are still those arguing for it, including, you know, the request that's sitting before Congress for $500 million in funding. The president put that forward. The Pentagon backs it. But the dateline on that one is 2015. It is certainly, that certainly would seem to be too late if the concern is containing ISIS right now and possibly defeating it. But it's a dangerous game and a dangerous gamble to start talking about empowering Assad, who yesterday, by the way, was the one-year anniversary of the Assad regime gassing to death over 1,000 people. And so if you're going to cut bargains with dictators like that, there are going to be consequences. And that's something the Pentagon warned about just yesterday. He's part of the problem. And Assad actually freed a number of these terrorists from jail when this uprising began, according to a number of diplomatic sources who say that this was really part of a long game here to try to win the support of the West to say, I'm the guy you should be backing against the extremists.
Clarence, is utterly galling to end up somehow in the same camp as Assad, potentially. On the other hand, giving $500 million in arms to the moderate Syrian forces now, which have not done so well, seems pretty scary when we already see tons of American arms in the hands of ISIS that they've taken from the Iraq that we armed up.
That's right, and that is the dilemma that the Obama administration is dealing with. The old adage about the enemy of my enemy is my friend. We're not so sure that's the case over there, and the ground constantly shifts. So, but Assad would certainly appear to be the stronger ally. But it looks hypocritical of us to be supporting him right in the wake of his many other atrocities. But at the same time, the moderates their strength is questionable right now. So it's a very tough call.
Jack, what's your level of confidence these days in Washington's ability to wade back in here? I mean, do we have the option of not doing that when ISIS is so fiercely on the move? If we do, what's your level of confidence we'll get this right?
Well, it seems to me in the last couple of weeks we have got a lot right. I mean, the Yazidis were saved. Erbil was the thrust, ISIS thrust to Erbil was countered. And the Mosul Dam taken back. Again, 60% of that, according to an Iraqi on the ground, owing to U.S. 35, U.S. airstrikes. So we've been successful so far. Can we go beyond that? Can we somehow calibrate an equivalently Machiavellian strategy vis-a-vis Syria to counter the eminently Machiavellian Assad? I don't know. But, you know, whatever you do in these matters, you get dirty hands. And I guess it's a matter of trying to figure out which is the larger threat. Assad poses no threat to this country, none. ISIS may well. And that could well tip the balance in terms of bombing in Syria. And as you suggested, Tom, while we're there, we could perhaps even the score by bombing a little bit of Assad's people, too.
I mean, you say no threat, but he may have set up a bunch of the situation that put ISIS up on its feet. Much more to come on that front. A lot going on in this country this week. Here's Tuesday night, Ferguson, Missouri, the sound of police telling protesters they had to leave the area in Ferguson or face arrest. Move back, telling protesters there. It got rough sometimes on all sides. Certainly we've seen a lot of heavy equipment in the streets, and then the effort to pull that back. Still exasperation among many of the African-American citizens of Ferguson.
The only thing that we ask is for equality. In 2014, we still on the struggle, and it's insane.
Last night, a little calmer. Here was Missouri Highway Patrol Captain Ron Johnson, who's emerged as such a prominent figure here, in charge of security of the St. Louis suburb, saying early Friday that this was a second night of relative calm, only 7 arrests.
We had to respond to fewer incidents tonight. There were no Molotov cocktails tonight, no fires, no shootings. We did not seize a single handgun. Again tonight, we deployed no smoke devices, no tear gas, and no mace. And again tonight, no police officer fired a single shot.
And yesterday, the Attorney General, Eric Holder, talking about his Wednesday visit to Ferguson.
I wanted the people of Ferguson to know that I personally understood that mistrust. I wanted them to know that while so much else may be uncertain, this Attorney General and this Department of Justice stands with the people of Ferguson.
Let's go right to our callers, Eswar in Andover, Massachusetts. Eswar, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Tom. Beheading a Foley is horrible, I agree. But suppose he was shot 6 times and left to bleed for 4.5 hours before calling for any assistance. Would that have been acceptable? And then we are pretending to go into war again? Can we not put an end to this American arrogance, for heaven's sake?
Eswar, it's a provocative framing of the question. Clarence Page, you hear it.
I presume he's talking about Michael Brown.
Yes, of course.
In Ferguson, right. It's been a week of crises. There's no question about that last couple of weeks. Looking at the fires in the night over Ferguson, stores set on fire by rampaging crowds as protests, you know, broke down, and suddenly you had these apparent thug provocateurs. I couldn't help but feel that deja vu all over again to the 1960s. I went back and reread the Kerner Commission report, which President Johnson commissioned back in 67, and it's been exactly 20 years since the first Harlem riots broke out in 64, and that set off 5 years of battles. And as you can see in the commission report, outside of Dr. King's assassination and the riots that followed that event in 68, most all the urban riots in the 60s, and there were dozens and dozens, almost all of them started with a police shooting or some other fracas over police conduct. I look at the Ferguson situation, and I see a city and a police chief that did not learn any of those lessons, didn't implement any of them. The circumstances that led to the violence in Ferguson was very much like the 60s. Ron Johnson, on the other hand, and Eric Holder, very familiar with those times, and so is the governor. Give him credit there in Missouri for putting things into the control of the State Highway Patrol, which is where Ron Johnson comes from. And even then, after that, he was undercut by the city officials who released this videotape of this alleged strong-arm robbery, which was not directly related to the shooting of Brown later on. But this, they did this without notifying the governor or the State Highway Patrol, just undercutting their efforts. And that night, you saw a resurgence of violence. So it's like so many of these lessons. Some people have learned the lessons of the past. Others have not. And it leads to a situation where what should have been a local tragedy turns into a national controversy.
Jack, such a racial chasm in the way this was perceived, if the polls are correct. I mean, in the streets of Ferguson, you could not miss the urgency, the anguish in people's voices. Yes, there was anger. Yes, there was some looting going on there. There was some rough stuff in the streets as well. And Ron Johnson, Captain Johnson, called that out. But there was a lot of anguish over African-Americans saying, look, as we heard in that clip, we still don't have equality. We're not being treated right here. We don't feel like we've got justice. You look at the polls, and many white Americans just weren't seeing things in racial terms. What about that chasm, Jack?
Oh, it's there. Clarence mentions President Johnson's the Kerner Commission. This is our basic conclusion, the commissioners wrote. America is moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. The commission fingered white America's indifference to the troubles besetting black America as a background cause of the 60s riots. You know, today in the public reaction to Ferguson, as you suggest, Tom, the two Americas leap out in the polls. Two-thirds of blacks believe the police overreacted to the disorder of on the streets. Only a third of whites shared that view of the militarized response.
Let me go to Lucius in Franklin, Tennessee. Lucius, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hello.
This past week, you had a segment on the Ferguson situation. I tried to get in, but it was just busy.
Mm-hmm.
My take on it is this, you know, and this, first of all, when you get stopped by the police, whether it's a traffic ticket, you know, I've gotten stopped by white police, and as a black man, and I have my registration, my driver's license, and my insurance card out, and I'm cordial and I'm nice. Even if they get abrasive, I still try to be nice because they are an authority figure. You know, that's the first tier. When it gets up to that second and third tier as far as shooting and rioting, you know, that takes care of itself, and hopefully these people will be honest and follow the evidence. But as a black man, I respect the authority because I was taught to respect the authority.
But, Lucius, let me ask you. I mean, you're thoughtfully looking on here, but the message we've heard from Ferguson is that the authority has been abused. I mean, right or wrong, we heard that again and again in the streets. They feel that they have not been treated respectfully, correctly by the police over a long time. They've got a bigger complaint as well about unemployment and poverty there that has led some to say, we can't just respect authority without looking at these issues of respect to ourselves and justice around that. Does that sound like just, you know, flap jaw, or do you understand what they're talking about?
Of course, Tom, we would have never heard about this, about Ferguson, even if Ferguson existed, if this hadn't happened. Now, Franklin, Tennessee is near Nashville. Last night, one of our prominent ministers got the chief of police and the commanders and everybody together at a town hall meeting last night to say, if this happened in Nashville, what can we do to prevent it? So they got proactive last night. Ferguson should have been proactive a long time ago because they said that they had some issues in their community before.
Yes.
I'm saying if you get proactive and know your policemen. I live in Franklin, which is about 50,000 plus people.
Mm-hmm.
I've gotten to know the policemen as a youth minister to tell my young folks and let them know when you get stopped. Because this young man probably didn't know that the policeman had heard about a robbery a few minutes earlier.
But as far as we know, there was not that awareness, and he was not connecting it to Michael Brown. Lucis, I've got more callers here. I appreciate yours. Let me get one more, and I'll bring it to you, Clarence Charles in Dorchester, Massachusetts. Charles, you're on.
Yes, hi, Tom. Hi. I love the show. Just a little bit of experience. I've been in this country for 30 years. I'm from Haiti originally.
Yeah.
I've noticed 8 out of 10 times when I'm approached by a police officer doing a traffic, traffic situation,
yep.
8 out of 10 times they always approach me with a negative attitude, always trying to provoke the situation. Even though I remain calm and I hold my composure,
yes.
I go out of my way to be very polite and nice. But they're still trying to provoke me to do something or react so they can put me either under arrest or something. I don't know what it is. I think it's just a culture in the white cops community.
Charles, I appreciate you raising that, and forgive me for jumping in there as well, but our time is short before the break, and I want to bring it to you, Clarence. I mean, 8 out of 10 times Charles says he's provoked by white policemen. I haven't been approached by policemen 8 or 10 times in my life. I have to say, Charles' experience is different.
Tom, have you heard about the talk?
Yes, I have, that black parents giving their children about how to deal in that situation.
That is correct. That is correct. Just like right after you, in fact, before you talk about sex, you talk about how to deal if the cops stop you, especially if you have a son like I do.
But is there a point at which—
Especially a son with dreadlocks
yes,
like I do.
Yes, okay. Mm-hmm. But is there a point at which you might understand, Clarence, that people would say, wait a minute, enough?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's exactly what I was referring to before. You know, any community, I don't care what color you are, if your community is being hassled, harassed, disrespected by the authorities, you're going to just, after a certain point, revolt. And it's happened probably with every ethnic group that we've had in this wonderfully diverse country of ours. It's just that certainly with African Americans, it's just gone on and on. Now, one of those riots I referred to earlier, by the way, in 1966 was in Chicago, in the Puerto Rican community.
Mm-hmm.
This is we have a long history of this kind of thing in America, and smart cops know how to avoid this. As the caller just talked about, being proactive in your community means you have good community policing, you have police and community working together, you're able to solve more crimes that way, you get a better community overall. And Ferguson, let us hope that they learn the lessons locally there, and it's up to them. Their next election is going to be coming up, and black turnout has been very low in off-year elections in the past. I'll be interested to see how they respond now after this recent fracas.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Pope Francis in Asia, Catholicism's great frontier, he said. In Seoul, South Korea, in his first speech in English, he spoke of peace and the Korean Peninsula.
Peace can be won through quiet listening and dialogue rather than by mutual recriminations, fruitless criticism, and displays of force.
They're the Pope in English. 13-year-old Monet Davis, breakout star of this year's Little League World Series, can throw a 70-mile-an-hour fastball. Here she is speaking to ESPN about her strategy on the pitcher's mound.
Some people might not like it low and outside, so I'll throw it low and outside. Some people like swing at curveball. Some people swing at first pitch, so I know when to throw the right pitch at the right time, and I have to make sure that all my pitches are working that day.
Monet Davis, pretty great. And Don Pardo, the voice of Saturday Night Live, dead at 8:96.
It's Saturday Night Live.
How many years on a permanent contract with NBC? Pretty incredible. We're talking about a week in the news. Ferguson, an ISIS beheading, Russian trucks in Ukraine. Rick Perry gets a mugshot. Margaret Brennan is with us, State Department correspondent for CBS News. Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune is here. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. What about the Rick Perry felony charges? Margaret Brennan, we've got these two Americans who are back in the U.S., in Atlanta, out of the hospital now, and we're told they're cured of Ebola, which is fantastic news. But we heard this week from Monrovia, Liberia, Doctors Without Borders emergency coordinator Linda Serum, saying that the rapid increase in Ebola patients is putting an unmanageable burden on treatment there.
Because at this stage, the outbreak is totally out of control, and we need to come up with other strategies to cope with the situation.
Margaret Brennan, what are you hearing out of Africa in so many countries now in big urban areas, parts of Liberia cordoned off by military and police there to keep it from spreading? This is rough.
It is. I mean, one of the big challenges is if you don't have the infrastructure in a country, the deep bench of medical research and people to help, it's really hard to respond to a crisis. And that's one of the things that diplomats have grappled with. You saw the State Department tell a number of its diplomats in countries like Sierra Leone and elsewhere, you need to send your families home because we can't protect them and we don't trust that the governments themselves in these countries have the ability. Even if they have the will, they may not have the ability to really sustain true treatment if Ebola isn't contained soon. And so it's one of the things that some of the World Health Organizations, the CDC and others are trying to struggle with here.
I mean, put a lid on this, we've been told for a long, long time, and it is quite manageable. But without a lid on it, this is something else again.
Exactly. And that's why there's concern about, transiting of some of these passengers these patients who might be passengers on planes, who might have contact with others. And, some have said that's overreaction to try to restrict movement of nationals from Nigeria, from Sierra Leone. But at this moment, it's really hard to judge unless you're a medical professional what's the real dose of reality and treatment that should be meted out here.
Margaret, can you move us on into the Middle East and Israel and Gaza? Ceasefire did not hold this week. Israel taking action, killing three top Hamas commanders, we're told. No more talks in Egypt. What's going on there, Margaret?
The fighting goes on. I mean, this is truly sort of guns of August here. I mean, you look around and in the Gaza area, you are continuing to see humanitarian crisis with so many civilians still exposed to the brutality of Hamas and to the Israeli response militarily. Those ceasefire talks, they seem to be kind of on ice at the moment. There's still hope that there could be some diplomatic achievement. I spoke to an Israeli official at the end of last week who was saying, you know, he really thought that the Israeli military offensive put Hamas in check, and they have to make a big decision here about whether they want to engage politically and actually allow in either the Europeans or the Jordanians or the Egyptians or the Palestinian Authority to control security at ports and passageways if they want to help the people of Gaza instead of continuing to fight and put those people in Gaza at risk.
So far, nobody talking about ending this anytime soon. And a seemingly unending standoff here. Here's Euronews yesterday reporting on that border between Ukraine and Russia. On the first of the Russian aid trucks in that convoy, what Moscow calls humanitarian convoy, and maybe it is, without Ukrainian assent, at least at first, those trucks moving from Russian territory into eastern Ukraine.
The first trucks from a Russian aid convoy stuck for almost a week at the border with Ukraine have reportedly passed a checkpoint on their way to deliver what Moscow says are humanitarian supplies to civilians.
All right, Margaret, bring us up to date on this one. I mean, there had been advances by the Ukrainian troops, but then we've still got, we're reading here, lots of Russian activity on the other side of the border and continuing resistance, of course, in eastern Ukraine to Kiev and the Ukrainian Central Authority. What's going on?
Well, to be quite honest with you, U.S. intelligence is trying to figure that out right now. I was talking to a U.S. official earlier about these reports of what's happening with that Russian convoy that has moved into Ukraine. Ukrainian government says that amounts to an invasion. U.S. officials, at least at first glance, said, it's an incursion. We're not quite sure what this is going to mean. But it's been no secret. It's been out there that Russia's been openly not only firing across border, but providing weapons, heavy weapons, cross border into Ukraine. So this is it's a hot war, and it's pretty much out there that Russia is party to it. The next thing on the calendar in terms of addressing it, I'd say, would be this NATO meeting at the beginning of September. President Obama is going to be there, and you can expect that the European countries are going to come out as well and say, we've got to do something, but beyond sanctions, not clear what.
Let's go to Dave, calling from Needham, Massachusetts. Dave, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I was calling about the Bank of America settlement.
$16-17 billion, very big number.
Yes, it's a large amount of money, and it seems to me that while I applaud Eric Holder's visit to Missouri, I definitely withhold applause for his failure to prosecute any of these banks criminally. It seems like what he's reinforcing is this concept that there is a pay-to-play scheme, and if you are a financial institution beyond a certain size, the laws that the rest of us are supposed to be held accountable to do not apply.
Yeah, let us pick it up. Jack Beatty, here we are with Bank of America. Very big number here, $16-plus billion, though many, they get to discount what they've already paid out in forgiven loans there, I guess, which would make it a lot less. This is for them dealing in subpar mortgages that eventually brought on the big crisis. And it's a big number, but nobody in jail. Our caller's not happy, Jack.
It's hard to say that $16 billion amounts to a slap on the Rolexed wrist, yeah. but the case is pretty clear. It's as our caller suggests, as Dave suggests. Yes, there's been no prosecutions of individuals, but even worse, in this case, as a thorough investigative piece in the New Republic points out, there was no disclosure of the, you know, in other words, there was no charge, nothing that came forward and was publicized about who did what, when, and why in that business. All of that was sunk. All of that information has disappeared as a result of this settlement. And, you know, people say, you know, yes, the threat of going to jail will deter, but so will the threat of exposure, of being fingered as I'm the person that made this decision, you're the one who made that decision. It tarnishes the record of the executives in question, and it says to other executives, you'd better be careful. In this case, all that has disappeared.
Big number, but maybe not full deterrence. Let's go to Iowa. Iowa City. Rick is calling. Rick, you're on the air.
I'd like to talk about the Rick Perry incident, or I guess situation.
Indictment. He went in to be booked in Austin. Mugshot. We've all seen that. He was not happy about it. He said this is pure politics.
Yeah. last night on MSNBC, they were talking to a writer from the Dallas Morning News. And he mentioned in Texas, they're looking at it much differently than the rest of the nation and national media that is not politics, that the judge that convened the grand jury is a Republican that was appointed by George W., and the special prosecutor was appointed to his office by George, excuse me, George then won first, and that two other district attorneys had been charged with drunk driving under Perry, both Republicans. Neither one had been asked to resign, but this one was because she was a Democrat.
So you're saying it's is depicted as all politics, but maybe you're not buying that, Rick. Certainly, that I mean, Rick Perry himself is certainly presenting it as all politics. We've got a little sound of him as he was heading into the Austin, Texas courthouse. A grand jury indicted him on two felony counts of threatening to veto funding for a district attorney after pressuring her to get out of the job, in effect. Here's the Texas governor.
I'm going to enter this courthouse with my head held high, knowing the actions that I took were not only lawful and legal, but right.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Clarence Page, I don't know how closely you've been following this, but it was interesting, to Rick's point,
I
in Iowa City.
It for the world.
Well, I mean, here, the Wall Street Journal says, Wall Street Journal writing says, San Antonio lawyer Michael McCrum, this is the special prosecutor behind this indictment of the Republican Governor Rick Perry, described by colleagues, the Wall Street Journal saying here, as a steadfastly apolitical straight shooter, former police officer turned federal prosecutor turned criminal defense lawyer appointed by a GOP state judge to review Mr. Perry's actions after he pressed this elected Democratic district attorney to resign after she was arrested for drunk driving. They're from the Journal. So is this political theater? Is this just political, or is there something real underneath? What do you say?
Well, even my former intern, David Axelrod, says that this Perry's indictment seems pretty sketchy. But nevertheless—
Mr. Obama's man, okay.
Mr. Obama's man, that is right. And I taught him everything he knows. But nevertheless, this is more serious than it may appear on the surface. Within Texas, the law and the prosecutor in this case are quite reputable. But it may be a case of what Tom DeLay would call the criminalization of politics. And this is what happens when the way politicians normally behave becomes criminalized. And it's going to, I think, the question about what is an abuse of power in Texas and in the context of Rick Perry's governorship and all is going to be the question in court. But politically, people are divided over whether this helps or hurts Perry, at least as far as Texas politics go, and then insofar as getting the Republican nomination, since the Tea Party wing certainly likes their feisty types.
Let's ask Texas about it. Andrew in Austin, Texas. You're on the air. Thanks for calling, Andrew.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
What do you see
going on here, Andrew?
Well, I actually have close friends who are in politics in Texas. And the issue that is being brought up by this indictment is that Perry used his office and the threats of the veto to get a desired result, which was that he'd be able to appoint the district attorney. Had he not used his position of power to try to force an outcome, we wouldn't even be having an indictment. If he had just vetoed it and not said anything about it, there would be no crime committed.
But politics is all about, be careful, or I might do this, or I might do that. Or maybe I'm being too cynical there, Andrew.
Well, those are the rules and laws that were written into the Texas Ethics Commission that he broke, and he just figures that, you know, by being the bombastic political figure in Texas, that he can continue to ride that, and nothing will really happen. Nothing of consequence will happen.
Andrew, I appreciate your call from Austin, Texas, where it's all been going down. Jack Beatty, do you think he'll shake it off here? He's talking about another run for the presidency. He said he's going to fight it with every fiber of his being. Andrew in Austin isn't so sure it's bogus. What do you think, Jack?
Well, you know, F. Scott Fitzgerald said there are no second acts in American life, but Rick Whoops Perry, he's trying to prove Fitzgerald wrong. Yeah. He's turning his indictment into a tool of GOP voter incitement. He's yesterday gave a hawkish speech on ISIS at the Heritage Foundation. This weekend, he's campaigning in New Hampshire. He's at 5% in the latest poll up here. And, you know, apparently he's still on the stage of his first act as president in presidential politics, when in the New Hampshire primary of 2012, he ran sixth, winning only 1,700 votes.
Watch this space. Clarence Page, James Foley just stays on my mind this week. I cannot leave it. So horrible, and where we go with ISIS, so consequential, but also Ferguson. And I wonder if your sense, it was calmer last night, calmer for a couple of nights now. Are we through this? Are we just beginning a new conversation here? How do you see the aftermath of the ongoing fact of it?
Well, I have my fingers crossed that indeed things are quieting down. They're getting a better handle on things and pulled the National Guard out, which is good. It's important that the authorities remove any unnecessary provocations, and that's what the Guard can represent if you're not careful. And cooperation between local police and the state police is crucial here. Also, I think that to some degree, the latest police shooting over in St. Louis may have had an effect insofar as sobering some attitudes, because that one looks more like the perhaps a suicide by cop situation or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. In any case, the discussion is getting elevated, and I can't emphasize enough that there were outside provocateurs and thugs who came in and caused trouble in Ferguson. A number of them have been rounded up. And Ron Johnson, the state police captain, is very knowledgeable about crowd control, even teaches it at a university. So let's hope that the right lessons are being put into place now.
Lessons, big lessons. We hope they're listened to and the whole country really thinks about what we've been seeing there. What a summer. Tough on many, many fronts. FXX trying to give a little relief for the back-to-back marathon of The Simpsons. 500-plus installments all in a row. Oh, boy, we'll go out with that theme. Clarence Page at the Chicago Tribune, thank you very much for being with us today, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
Margaret Brennan at CBS News. Thank you, as always, Margaret.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, thank you for being here, sir.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Off with The Simpsons. We can use some relief. This is On Point.